Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. This is News Talk.
You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram and ask Claire's Lair. Coming up, executive chef Tricia Lewis on changing her mindset and losing 8 stone in a year. She's now gained Ireland's best-selling book, Tricia's Transformation. Dr. Lisa Moscone on how watching her grandmothers get dementia inspired her to study brain health, particularly in women, and how you can strengthen yours. And I'll be joined by journalist and podcaster Leah Dawn Hines about her new book, How to Fall Apart, and how she picked up the pieces when life served a curveball. So what kind of health and wellness week did I have? Well, I actually took it easy this week. I often talk about my exercise endeavours and all that side of things, but I was feeling a little under the weather. And God, that carries so much more weight these days, and rightly so. We have to be very cautious about mixing with others if we feel unwell. And I did just feel a little run down. It reminds me of those last few weeks before you have your baby and every twinge you think, is this it? Now with illness, you kind of think, is this it? But anyway, it's not as fun as being handed a baby. But I didn't have anything serious, but I decided to just listen to my body. I shelved some of the workouts at the start of the week. I went for walks, gentle yoga class, and got some early nights. And I do think it's really important to listen to the body and adjust your routine. And thankfully, that did the trick and I'm back to normal now. And I finally got into the sea this week. I have been listening for years about the benefits of sea swimming from when I read I Found My Tribe by Ruth Morris, which I know I've mentioned on the show before, from Niall Nimurucu, who teaches the Wim Hof method here in Ireland. I did the ice bath with him. And you don't have to go that far. You can just do the cold shower or get into the sea. And even closer to home, I've been listening to it from some of my very close friends, and even my husband has gone mad for it, and I've been watching them all come beaming out of the sea, and I just hadn't managed to do it. But finally, I got in this week. We're very lucky to have lots of gorgeous places to swim close enough to where I live. So yeah, I loved it. I mean, I say swim, but I mean dip, but enough to feel the cold waters, to take it in. You then adjust to the temperature. And you do feel really incredible. All that talk we've been doing about getting into nature and what that does to you. I mean, you're fully immersed in it. You're in the sea. And I hope to make it a regular occurrence. And I'd recommend Sheila Shoiga's podcast with June Burke of Snavi Sosta. That's a swimming group at Spanish Point in County Clare. It's well worth a listen. June speaks so beautifully about her story of loss, which led her to get into the sea, and how restorative it has been for her and everyone who now attends on a Sunday. I mean, obviously, the meets didn't happen over lockdown when there were hundreds of people attending from all over the country. But they have begun again in recent weeks with social distancing in place. And this week I started an online motivation course with Andy Ramage. He was on the show a few weeks back about his book, Let's Do This. And he invited me to take part in his office athlete course, which has been very interesting so far. So I learned this week about habits, and I better not give away all his secrets, but I will give you something he taught us, which I found fascinating. And it's about building habits. And he said that when we set out on a goal, we often make it too hard. And the example that he gave was meditation. So you might say, that's it. I want to start meditating, and I'm going to meditate every morning for 10 minutes. And I would have thought that that was quite achievable. But Andy says, no, that's way too hard. You have to start so small that your brain says, I can do that. He said literally for the first 3 weeks, all you should do is plant your 2 feet on the ground getting out of bed and hit the Headspace app. You don't even listen to it. You don't even put the headphones in your ear. But you do that for 3 weeks. And after 3 weeks, then you start listening to a minute and you build it up and you build it up, because your head's like, well, I can hit the Headspace app every morning. So that's easy. But then within 3 weeks, it's become part of the fabric of what you do in the morning, and you build it from there. So I'll keep you posted on any more little bits and pieces that I learn. And mindset is something that Tricia Lewis had to take on when she says she was at her lowest inside when she was at her heaviest weight, and she decided to make a change. She's lost 8 stone and also gained a massive following online and a best-selling book, Tricia's Transformation. She's on the line now. Hello, Tricia.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Now, Tricia, I always want to start out in an interview like this. Like, it's so important to me that in health and wellness, we don't focus on how we look. And I know we can't say 26 stone is a healthy weight. But what's almost more important to me in your story is that that wasn't a happier time for you and you are happier now.
Yeah, that I kind of very quickly in my journey, I realised that the number was nearly irrelevant. It was what I was feeling. So I kind of, like the happiness that I have now, I had a 25 stone, 24 stone. And I'm not just saying that, it was just, I had decided that I was going to chase the feeling, not the number.
And I was listening in researching for this to some of the interviews you've been giving. And you talk about the weight you had, not only on your body, but on you, that it was really bringing you down. And it was weight related.
Yeah, 100%. I suppose the max that I tipped on the scales was 27 stone. And you can imagine being 27 or 28, that was fairly tough to kind of deal with, because I wasn't able to do any of the normal things that I suppose you do in your 20s. I was more, I kind of restricted myself as with the weight. So I found that over the years, I started to get very kind of in and myself. Like, I'm always a positive person. I always have great crack wherever I go. Like, and if it wasn't, like tears of a laughing clown, I literally always, I love laughing. I love having just fun. And then I thought that's when I realized things had gone really bad for me, was when I just didn't find anything fun. I didn't find my friends funny, and I was just like allergic to life. And I found myself that on my days off, instead of, if I would be canceling cups of coffee with my friends, and I would just lie in bed for the day, and just my mental health took a serious hammering, I suppose. And you know, I'm so proud of where I've come from, because I know how bad it went on me. And it was coming from weight, but I think the weight was manifesting from that. It was just all this vicious cycle that I seem to have trapped myself in.
And how did it become that, do you think? Was it a love for food? Was it the chef lifestyle? I mean, I know there's some people who are just more predisposed to put on weight than others, or have a bigger appetite than others. But what do you think it was that led to that?
I think there was a number of factors. So I'm the executive head chef of Jacobs on the Mall, and I absolutely love food. But I think the ironic thing is I love good food. I was never a takeaway junkie. Now, towards the end, I was like, right, I'll just start drinking Coke, because what else can I do now? Just, you know, I was just choosing negative and bad food choices at the end. But I would say it was 100% portion size was a problem of mine with years, because when I was younger, my beloved Nana, I used to go up and visit her every day, every single day, and we'd have a big dinner of like chicken and soup and spuds, like really home cooked proper food. And then I would come down home, but I would have never told Mam I had a dinner above. So I created a big appetite for myself from maybe the age of 3, 4, and 5. And then I thought Nana passed away, and I kept up those habits, but without my mother copying it, because then it developed into secret eating. And then I suppose my job was around food the whole time. So I think it was just a number of factors. And it was also no routine, no rhyme, no rhythm. It was just, I would eat when all the food was served in the restaurant. And that could be 10 o'clock at night. You'd be having some potatoes, which, you know, realistically, do you really need to have it at 10 o'clock at night? So I think it was definitely portion size. And the cliche, I think, with obese people is you sit on the couch and you eat McDonald's. And I really, really don't like that food. I much prefer like sautéed potatoes with like monkfish, but it's the portion size was my problem.
Yeah, and then exercise wasn't a factor in your life. And we'll talk about you walking into the gym, because that's such a massive step that you made. But I want to touch on life at that time, because I do remember many years ago on another radio programme interviewing a woman who had had gastric surgery, and she had gone from morbidly obese to sort of the size 8 to 10. But she struggled more at that size because she found that people were being so nice to her since she'd lost the weight. But she said at her heaviest, she felt invisible, that she would spend her day getting the bus to town, going to work, and have nobody really, really talk to her. And she was still the very same person. And that just completely shocked me, that people are made to feel that way based on their size.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's something I hadn't really thought about, but I suppose that kind of nearly put a trigger in me. That's exactly how I felt. You'd feel, you feel like the biggest person in the room, but you feel like no one can really see you, which is, yeah, I get that. But now, like, but then again, I would have put up a front that I suppose maybe I wasn't approachable, or, you know, because I was too busy worrying that someone might call me a name. I'd be like, right, just don't look at anyone, look at the ground. Now, I'm not saying that my friends might be feeling a bit invisible. God love them. Their hearts are broke trying to find every route to get me even out. And they were like, look, we'd all drink sparkling water. I was like, no. I have a thing in the morning. They knew I didn't. But yeah, you feel different when you're morbidly obese. You are treated a little bit different, but not by everyone. And I mean that now, it's by the minority. But then again, I suppose everyone does glance. It's like, that's the part that I don't miss and my family don't miss and my friends don't miss. Like walking down the street and my stomach was just below my knees. And everyone, no matter what age they were, no matter what gender, they would just automatically glance and look at it. And that could happen 50 times walking down the South Mall. So that's the kind of things I don't miss, because I used to be so either upset or angry going down, going, it's just the stomach, lads. Please, like leave it alone. I remember I thought it was just me that copped it. But then the night that I went on the Late Late, my friend Dee was watching it with his girlfriend. And she was like, God, is this really what happened? Because he hadn't been going out with her when I was that bad. And he goes, Marie, I'd be walking down the street and I'd want to actually kill everybody because they just never stopped looking at her stomach. So that's the kind of things I don't miss.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. So you say 2017 was rock bottom for you. Why? What was it that happened that brought you to that standstill and then made you take that first and very tricky step?
I suppose there was a load of factors. We have a large family, so I have 8 sisters. And on Christmas Day, my sister Maura had twin baby boys a couple of months beforehand, and something had happened with their naps. So they had missed them all, and Mum was like, right, keep them down there now until they're normal and calm, and then bring them up. So what we'll do is we'll drop the dinner down to them. And I was like, yeah, I'll drop it down. And I stopped drinking at this stage because I was just very down. And my sister Anne Marie hopped into the car with me. Now, I mean, like, I'd throw a stone and it would go in the back window. It's that near, but I just wasn't able to walk. And my car was blocked in due to loads of family members being home. And I took Dad's car and I got stuck behind the wheel. So my sister, who was a couple of months pregnant, had to come around and tug me out like I was jammed. And I remember just saying, Annie, will you do me a favour and don't tell the girls? And she was like, look, I promise I won't, but we really need to talk about this. Because they've tried every single time of their life, like the good cop, bad cop, they were fitness cop, they were everything. And then in January of 2018, so a couple of weeks later, I joined the same girl, Anne-Marie, for a scan, and my whole world came crashing down because I have nieces and nephews that are just my whole world. And I remember hearing his heartbeat and I was like, oh my God, this is it. He won't know me. He never will know me. And either I'll be dead or I'll have a stroke or I'll be in a home or I'll be this sad Trish. And I remember we came out and the two of us were crying and I was like, I'm scared and I didn't know what to do. So about 2 weeks later, I got a text off the same girl and she said, look, it's the first Monday of February. I'm not asking you to lose weight. I'm not asking you any of that, but I am asking you for the sake of my baby. He needs you more than I need you. Will you try? And I texted her back and I said, no. I said I was done and I was so sorry for what I'd done to the family. And I can't do it. I was turning 30 in March and all I've ever achieved in this life is get fatter, and that I loved them all very much and I was just so sorry. And that was it. And I don't know what happened, but I remember I threw the phone with temper and within an hour I was standing in front of the gym in Cork.
It's absolutely incredible, the winds of change, as you say, even to let the air change. Something just changed. And I've been well enough even thinking that you would feel that low about yourself, but you made the step. And something that you really get across to your 128,000 followers on Instagram is that it hasn't been easy and it took time. It's not like you walked into that gym and then the weight started falling off and you were like, I'm here, I'm in my new life. It took ages. It took ages for you to be able to look in the mirror, to get used to the exercises, to not feel mortified. But you built it up slowly but surely.
Yeah, and it's really like topping up your SIM card. Like, just keep adding what you can. Sometimes you run out of credit. Other times you have a load of credit. So just keep going, because, like, it's not easy, but it's the easiest thing I've ever done in my entire life, if that makes sense. I'm gonna, like, a lot of people say, oh, you feel great now after 2 weeks. That's complete lies. You're like, if you are in the position I was in, it does take maybe 8 weeks, 9 weeks for you to truly feel the benefits of the exercise, because at the start you're miserable. You're like, oh my God, I'm so sore. I have so many glands. My arms don't feel like my arms. They feel like foreign objects in my body. What's going on? And then you're just kind of a little bit embarrassed inside your own head. And then just one day you will realize that you'll go, you know what? No one actually cares. I'm just going to get this done. for me, because, you know, I think people want it now and want it fast. And I remember I always dreamed that someday I might wake up and this was all a nightmare. And imagine what that would be like if I walked down and I was in a size 8. You know, and you imagine all these scenarios. But that doesn't happen overnight. Like, and I think that by now I could have lost way more weight. But I don't know what I have kept it off. At least I know with my approach that I'm chipping away slowly and surely, because the destination isn't what matters. Like being 10 stone, yeah, it would be great now. But would I, if you offered me to me right now or to continue on the next 2 years to get there, I'd pick the 2 years, because what I've realised and what I was never taught about weight loss culture is the journey is the most fun part. You get up every single day and you have something to do, and that's to do with you feeling good. Like a lot of people, like think of the healthiest person in the world. They're just healthy. They're happy. That's their high. Now you're going from, you're just building up like to euphoria. And I want to put that home to people. And if they have done a diet and gained 5 stone afterwards and all messed up, that's grand. That's just feedback. That particular diet wasn't for you. That doesn't mean you give up. Because I remember I made that promise on her bump that I wasn't going to give up. I would always try, no matter how bad it got. And that bump turned into baby Danny, who became my godson in June.
I'm sure they're all so proud of you. And you do speak in your book about the support that you've had. And when did the book deal come about? Because that must have been a very exciting moment for you.
Would you believe it's actually tomorrow last year? So basically 1 year ago, I got an email. I was on the Ryan Tubridy show and I got an email from Sarah at Gill Publishing. And she just said, I'd love to meet you for a cup of coffee. I don't know, have you ever thought about it? And I'd say I'd text back within, I'd email back within a minute. I was like, hey, yeah, no problem. When's the book going to be on shelves? So they were looking at December 2021 and I was like, no, I kind of want to do it now. But they were like, look, it takes a lot to write a book. But I was like, look, if you give me 2 years, I'm just going to write it in the last 3 months. Anyway, I'm not that type of person that'll do a chapter a month. So they're like, look, if you can get it into us by October the 31st, we'll get your book out in shelves in March. And I think it was November the 10th or something. I was like, right, there we go, lads. And it was one of the most difficult things I've ever done in my entire life, because the restaurant was fully booked to graduations every single night. The photo shoot for the food was in December. I was like, oh my God. But I mean it, like when I handed it over, it's just, it was so good, because I felt like it was my truth. Every single thing I put in because I felt that I needed to put it out there and that someone could pick this book up and go, that's me. And I am so proud that the message I get now is, thank you, Trish. I finally don't feel like I was alone. I finally feel like I have a bit of hope. And that's all what I want to hear, because people are struggling. And I don't mind being the one that's shouting from the rooftop saying, lads, it's all right. Your stomach might be below your knees, but you can get it up. Keep it going.
And then when you went on the Late Late Show to talk about it, you got a standing ovation. And well deserved, because you spoke about your darkest hour and you spoke about feeling so low that you rang the Samaritans, and to be standing there and to have a best-selling book, do you think about how far you've come?
I do, and I'm so thankful every single day that I've just decided to get out of my own way, because like that night, I remember that night in the Late Late, I was like, why are they interviewing me? I'm still really big. But I was, you know, you kind of get into your own head. And then I was like, no, they're interviewing, because I remember Ryan had said, we're interviewing you because you're Trish. And I remember it was just the best feeling in the world, and everyone started standing. I was like, oh my God, what's happening? It was just surreal. So when I look back on all those moments, I'm just so proud, because I think sometimes you look at before and afters and people are like, and I remember I was doing that and I was like, God, look how bad my head was there, and look how big my stomach, and look how bloated my hands are. And it was actually my sister who said, Trisha, can you just stop being so cruel? And I was like, what do you mean? She was like, that's the girl we loved. That's the girl that was our sister, and you're there mocking her. She was like, please don't do what everyone did to you already. Do you know, a bit of respect. So now when I look back at old Trish, I'm like, oh my God, you're the most adorable thing in the world. Thank you so much. Because that Trish and that starting point for anyone is the bravest person you'll ever meet in your entire life, because it is scary. It is like you spend years hating who you are, and weight is always seen as a negative and health risks. And yes, it is. But I just would love if someone put a twist in and go, do you know what? It is a health risk, but we're fixing it. That's the thing. The key is fixing it. Like, I'll never promote obesity. I'll never promote stay obese, like, because you want to. I always promote health. You want to, like, I find that every time I do an exercise, I say to myself, this is another day I'm adding to my life by just moving and taking back control. Because if you wait for motivation and you wait for willpower, is never going to come. It's just the worst word that can ever. It's setting people up for failure, and then this rat race of diets upon diets upon diets. It's all about discipline and saying, right, this is what I'm doing, and I'm not doing anything else different. I'm going to eat this food today, and then if I decide I'm going to have a Chinese, I'm going to be disciplined enough to say, that's my Chinese. Now the next day I'll go back on the bandwagon, because it's just a rat race, and I think everybody's so sick of trying to lose weight and it's not working. But look at it in the bright way. That's feedback. That's the feedback for you.
I think you're so impressive. I think, like I said to you at the start, obviously the changes you made to your body is very impressive. But I think what's more important is happiness and what you did with your head, that you reached out for happiness. And I think it's incredible. And thank you so much for coming on. The book is called Trisha's Transformation. It's out now and you can follow her at trishas.transformation on Instagram. Great talking to you. All the best. Keep going,
thank
sister.
Thank you. Big one.
Coming up after the break, Dr. Lisa Moscone on how watching her grandmothers get dementia inspired her to study brain health, particularly in women, and how you can fortify yours.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Dr. Lisa Moscone is a neuroscientist whose work focuses on brain health and in more recent years has looked at women's brains to find out why more women than men get degenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's. Her latest book is called The XX Brain and she's on the line from New York now. Hello, Lisa. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. What was it that led you to neuroscience? Your parents come from a science background, but I've read this wasn't necessarily the path that they had chosen for you.
I have no idea. I was six years old, and I told my parents I'm going to be a psychiatrist. And I really always wanted to understand mental health and brain function and behavior. I was really, really interested in behavior. At some point, I thought maybe I would study criminology, like CIA type thing, but that didn't work out. In Italy, it's quite complicated. But I really always wanted to look at brains. And my mom was teaching nuclear physics to a bunch of students who would babysit me, of course, on weekends. But then transferred to nuclear medicine, which is a branch of radiology. And so as soon as I was old enough, I reached out to them and said, can I volunteer? Can I come to your lab or can I come to the nuclear medicine department and just help out? Because I'm really super interested in brain imaging and brain scans and just learning everything I can. And they knew me. They knew that I'm very serious and very hardworking and very reliable. So they said yes, and as soon as I was 19, I started doing that, and I just never stopped.
We are talking more now about mental health. We've begun to talk more about a holistic view of our health, and links are being discussed more recently about the gut-brain axis and their connection. But that seems to be relatively new. We don't tend to think of the brain beyond a thought generator. It's like we've forgotten how connected it is to all the systems in our body.
Yes. Still today, I think that most people really think about the brain as being relatively isolated from the rest of the body. Like we know that the brain is in charge of the rest of the body, but we don't fully appreciate how the rest of the body is actually also really providing information to the brain in real time. And a lot of my work has been really focused on the interactions between the brain and other organs, especially the reproductive system, which is so important for brain health in women.
And it was your grandmothers that inspired your look into brain degeneration in women.
Yeah, inspired is a very nice way to put it. Yes, when I was in college, my grandmother started showing signs of cognitive decline that eventually led to dementia. And my grandma was one of four siblings, three sisters and one brother. And all three sisters developed dementia, most likely Alzheimer's disease, and died of it, whereas their brother did not. And that was quite shocking for me and for my family. And we had a lot of questions. And I would go to my mentor at the university and say, what do we know about Alzheimer's disease and dementia? Does it matter if you're a woman, if you're a man? How does it work in terms of DNA and genetic transmission? Am I at risk? What do I do? And back then, there were just so few answers, and no one was looking at sex differences in Alzheimer's, gender differences in Alzheimer's. It was really not of interest to anyone. And it took a real long time to bring women's health really at the forefront of dementia research. Like I personally really work at the intersection between neurology, neuroscience, and women's health, which is a very strange thing to do.
And more women than men get Alzheimer's.
So Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. And it really affects so many people all over the world. Just here in the United States, we have almost 6 million Alzheimer's patients, and these numbers are expected to triple by the year 2050. And that's in the United States alone. And we know what kind of damage Americans can do sometimes, right? So the thing about Alzheimer's disease is that the prevalence is much higher in women than in men, so that out of every 3 Alzheimer's patients, 2 are women, which is really like saying for every man suffering from Alzheimer's, because nobody wants to downplay the effects of Alzheimer's in men, of course, but for every man suffering from Alzheimer's, there are 2 women. And this has been overlooked for decades.
And this isn't due to women having a longer life expectancy?
For a long time, that's what people thought. So when I started, which is a long time ago, almost 20 years ago at this point, people would just say to me, doctors and scientists would say to me, well, you know, the point is that Alzheimer's is a disease of old age and women live longer than men. So of course, more women than men have Alzheimer's disease. And it took a really long time to change the question to a very, very different one. So for context, women do not live that much longer than men to start with. In the United States, the difference is about 4.5 years. In England, in the UK, the difference is 2.5 years. But dementia is number one cause of death for women and not men, even though the difference is just a couple of years. So there's more to Alzheimer's disease than just longevity. And most importantly, we and others have shown that Alzheimer's is actually not a disease of old age. We associate it with the elderly because the symptoms usually emerge in old age. Here in the US, the mean age at onset of Alzheimer's is 71, 72. But in reality, the disease starts with negative changes in the brain years, if not decades, prior to cognitive symptoms. It really brings us back to midlife. And so that really changes your question to, if Alzheimer's disease starts in midlife, what happens to women and not to men in midlife that could potentially explain this higher risk of Alzheimer's, or something that could potentially trigger Alzheimer's disease in a woman's brain in midlife? And the answer that we came up with was menopause, which is very strange. If you work in neurology, neuroscience, you don't think about hormones as a determinant of brain health. But it turns out that our hormones have a huge impact on the health of our brains, as then the hormonal declines that take place during menopause seem to really either be associated with or trigger these Alzheimer's brain changes in women.
So that's one of the only differences between the male and female brain. You've studied both. And in interviews, you keep getting asked if men are from Mars and women are from Venus. But there's no such thing as a gendered brain. Our brains are essentially built the same.
Our brains are a little bit different. There's a lot of confusion over this gendered brain, right? Pink and blue, Barbie and Lego, different behaviors. Women have better memory. Men have better sense of direction. There are some subtle differences that are really related to our different DNA. So women are born with 2 X chromosomes and men are born with an X and the Y chromosomes. And this difference actually matters a little bit because the X chromosome contains almost 1,000 more genes than the Y chromosome. And many of these genes are really involved in reproduction, but also in brain function. And that means that as soon as the baby girl is conceived, within 3 months of conception, her brain is going to start developing in a way that promotes estrogens in the brain, estrogen action in the brain. Whereas the boy's brain, a little, you know, an infant's brain will promote production of androgens, like testosterone in a boy's brain. And that over time leads to differences, very subtle differences in structure and function. But most of all, our brains really differ in the way they age. We think of aging as a linear decline, right? That's the usual stereotype. After 35, you start losing neurons very slowly over time. That is true for men. Women's brains go through some proper cycles that have to do with puberty, with pregnancy, and then with menopause. And after menopause, our brains, women's brains, age faster than men's brains. And this is not universal, of course. It's more like on average.
That was something that was really interesting to me about your book, The Symptoms of Menopause, that everyone has heard of, the hot flashes, the mood swings. And they're not actually coming from the reproductive system. They're coming from the brain.
Right. Yes. Yes. I feel like in Western medicine, we have this tendency to just look at one organ at a time. And it's like we're made of different bits and pieces that somehow make a person, right? So if you think about women that way, then it makes sense to associate menopause with the ovaries, because your ovaries stop making hormones after a certain age and you get the symptoms like the hot flashes. But if you think about it, what kind of functionality do the ovaries have that make you feel hot or cold, right? It's impossible. This is something that the brain does. The brain is in charge of regulating body temperature. So if you think about it this way, it really makes sense. And I look at menopause from a neurological perspective, of course, from a brain perspective. And at that point, the hot flashes that women complain about, the night sweats, insomnia, depression, anxiety, the brain fog, the memory lapses, those symptoms don't start in the ovaries. They start in the brain. They come from the brain. They're neurological symptoms. We're just not used to thinking about them that way.
And they're all fairly hefty symptoms. They carry a lot of weight. And I've had an expert on the menopause in Catherine O'Keefe, the wellness warrior, to talk about the menopause and how we as a society view it. This idea that our power as a woman lies within our ability to have children. And we now know that that's not true. And even as your physical ability to do that comes to an end with menopause, it doesn't have to be a negative or the end or a time when things begin to break down, like your brain ability.
Absolutely, absolutely. And actually, I find it so offensive that there's this huge aging stereotype that really applies only to women, right? So as a society, we think of men as wine. The older they get, the more precious they become. For women, the analogy is more like milk, right? After a certain date, there's some suspicion over whether it's good or not anymore. And I just find this so bizarre. I think as women, we should really take the focus away from the way we look and really focus on our intellect and our capacities, because those don't have to decline, those don't have to change. And having kids is not the ultimate goal in a woman's life. You know, I mean, it's a wonderful part of a woman's life. I have a wonderful little girl and I love her so much, but there's also everything else after having kids. And I think what's really important is to look at our lives as a whole. At this point, most women spend over a third of their lives in a postmenopausal stage, right? And so why wouldn't that be a wonderful part of your life rather than a negative part of it? It just makes no sense. There's so much that women have to offer, and there are so many reasons to just celebrate our brains. Right? We never talk about women's brains, especially we never talk about women's brains as something to celebrate and really be proud of. And I think we should really be aware of all the wonderful things we can do. And in the book, I really try to, I do my best to reframe middle age and old age as lively parts of a woman's life that you can really have so much from. You can really, really enjoy every moment of your life, especially if you support yourself, because so many women, especially as we hit middle age, right? And we have children, we have husbands, we have elderly parents that need help, we have jobs, we have careers, we're trying to also keep it together ourselves, we're trying to get some sleep. There is so much going on. And for so many women, the tendency is to put yourself after everything else. And if nothing else, all the research is pointing to the fact that starting in midlife, our brains and their bodies need help. They need support, not in a negative way. They need support because we're going through a transition that, yes, comes with hot flashes and it comes with night sweats and it comes with depression with so many women. It comes with forgetfulness for so many women. So what I think we should really focus on is really follow all these recommendations that I include in the book and try to follow different strategies to support the health of our brains for a lifetime of use.
And it's so interesting that the true health message is really quite simple. The health and wellness sector is very cluttered and it can be so confusing. But when I speak to experts like you who have their evidence backed by science, the message of good health is always simple. It's fresh food. In the case of women, it's the Mediterranean diet for brain health. It's good sleep. It's exercise. It's reducing stress. And people don't seem to want to hear that it's really simple.
Yes, we don't want to hear it because then it's up to us, right? It's so much easier to go to your doctor and ask for a medication that you simply need to take, right? You're not accountable. It's more like it takes 3 seconds. You just need to remember to take it. Lifestyle changes are more, they really require discipline. They require discipline, they require commitment. But it's so important that we all follow these recommendations because number one, they're actually rooted in science. There is so much work and so much research showing that they might seem like just common sense, right? You have to eat healthily, you have to exercise, you have to sleep at night. But the point is that they make a huge difference on the health of your body and your brain as well. So yes, it takes discipline, but the benefits are really for life.
Well, I find it fascinating. I could talk to you all day. The book is called The XX Brain. And I would also recommend checking out Dr. Lisa Moscone's TED Talk, which has been viewed over 1.9 million times. And it was so well received, Lisa. People laughed in all the right places and you got a standing ovation. That must have felt good.
Oh, for sure. So one thing about women's brains is that we're so vulnerable in some ways to headaches and migraines. And that's what I start saying at the beginning of my talk, right? Women have twice the risk of anxiety and depression and then headaches and migraines. I had this huge migraine when I was giving the talk. I could not see from one eye.
Well, I'm sure the stress of preparing for a TED talk is colossal.
Well, I think it's just that my daughter was sick the night before and she was miserable. She had a stomach virus. She was only, 4. And so I was up all night just taking care of her. And in the morning, I got the virus. So I was miserable. I had this huge migraine. And yeah, it was an enormous relief when it went well. And
it just shows it's the same the world over. For women and for men, we're like swans. We look like we're gliding, but really beneath the surface, we're scrambling to keep it all together. Thank you for talking to me today, Dr. Lisa Moscone.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up after the break, journalist and podcaster Leah Dawn Hines on her new book, How to Fall Apart and How to Pick Up the Pieces When Life Serves You a Curveball.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
Leah Dawn Hines is a journalist in the business of people telling their stories, and she transcribes it into print for various publications. But it was her own personal story of marital breakdown which inspired her column on image.ie. Her podcast, How to Fall Apart, talks to people who have had to pick up the pieces. And she's just released her book of the same name, which documents her story and what she found helped with putting things back together. She's on the line now. Hello, Leah Dawn.
Hi, Claire. How are you?
Leah Dawn, I'm a big fan of your podcast.
Thank
and I've been
so much.
Speed reading through your book. It's so beautifully written. You can always tell a writer there's a rhythm to how they write and they pull all kinds of words out that you're like, yes, that's the perfect word for that. How does it feel
so
to have it out there and people actually reading it and it's on the shelves in bookshops?
It feels great, Claire. I thought I'd be really nervous because obviously it's quite a personal book, but I actually, I've just really enjoyed the whole thing. I suppose being in lockdown, everything was so kind of both mundane and also incredibly stressful at the same time. So I kind of decided going into this, okay, this is something I worked really hard on and now it's coming out and it's a book that's full of, you know, all the people that I love. So let's just enjoy it. And I suppose also the response that I'm getting from other women and men who have been in similar situations, it's just lovely to see that people are responding to it.
And when you were writing it, because as I say, there's a real rhythm to it, there's a flow to it. Did it just flow out of you, or did you need to be conscious of your daughter reading it in years to come, your ex-husband and his thoughts on it?
Of course.
And that could be a bit stop-starty, or did you just let it flow and think about that later?
Yeah, it's a very tricky balance, because I think if you're too conscious of anyone reading it, whether they're, like you say, in this case, someone who's actually in the book, or just people in general and what they will think of it, that can get you kind of really frozen. So it's finding a balance. I think you try to ignore that anyone's going to read this, but you also do go into it respecting the boundaries of others before you kind of start, because I suppose you don't want to go too far and then have to pull back on the people who are in the book.
Well, that is the gift of the book, I think, of your craft. You handle the ending of your marriage very well, because you do speak very openly and honestly about it. But obviously the details are personal to you and to him. And there's no sort of he said, she said. Was that a conscious decision to protect the story, or did it just happen, as you say in the books? It was just something, there was no catastrophe. It just sort of came to an end.
No, that's exactly it. And the book is very much about, I suppose, the aftermath, like you used the phrase earlier, picking up the pieces. And that's kind of, that was always the plan, that it would be about, you know, how you put things back together and how you deal with the fallout of a situation.
And when you were writing it, were you writing it for yourself, not in a selfish way, but just to get your story out there? Or were you really thinking about other people in this situation and wanting to let them know that you can pick up any pieces and change?
I suppose both, really. Like you said in your lovely intro, a lot of my work is about kind of interviewing people and talking about their lives and how they dealt with stuff and what they've experienced. And I just find that just so endlessly interesting. So I suppose this was kind of bringing that lens to my own story, but in a way that I would feel is quite universal. Like, I've had a lot of people text me and say, you know, it's like reading my life. I got a text the other day from somebody. So I suppose it was, you know, examining something that happens and how you cope with it. Something that obviously happened to me, but I suppose I would feel it's quite a universal kind of situation in a way.
I think so. And I obviously, it will be hugely beneficial to somebody who's going through a relationship breakup or breakdown. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the same of any big unexpected life event. And you talk a lot about acceptance and finally moving on, and how that can bring about a relief. I underlined a section which I just thought was so gorgeous. I'm going to read it, if that's not too cringeworthy for you.
That's lovely.
Oh, it's so beautiful. It says, if you're at that point in your life and you're full of fear, the kind of fear that makes you sick to your stomach, that hits you first thing in the morning before you even leave your bed, know that you can do it. Know that sometimes the ripping off of the plaster is the worst part. Few things are worse than stasis, than knowing deep down in your bones that the most intimate fabric of your life is rotten and not facing it. And I think it's so true, because we do have an intuition. We do have that gut feeling that tells us what we need to do, even though it's sometimes not a nice path we have to go down.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you got that from it, that the book, obviously it's specifically about a marriage ending, but I suppose I know this from interviewing people, that anyone, it doesn't really matter what the circumstances are, anyone has been through any massive change or shift or big loss that they have then had to come to terms with. We all go through the same things, obviously in differing degrees. And that moment, definitely, and I hear it from other women. I mean, I interviewed Daniela Moyles last week for the podcast, and she discussed this as well. It's that moment when you're kind of realizing, oh my God, this, things are not right. And it's kind of having the, it's being able to stay in that moment and kind of push through and get to the other side. And I think that's the hardest moment, because you're kind of looking into ripping up your entire life, and who runs into that willingly? You know, especially it's very easy to kind of bargain with yourself and say, well, you know, maybe we'll stay until she's 18 if you have a child, or, you know, maybe it's not that bad, or I should feel really lucky. Like, I, you know, look at my life, I should be happy. But I would say to anyone who is in that situation that is, well, I found anyway, that is the hardest moment. And the minute that you start facing it and making changes, you might not feel like it at the time, but you are taking control of the situation. And that makes things just start really, really incrementally becoming a little bit easier, because you're no longer just being buffeted around. You're putting yourself back in control in a small way.
Yeah, there's a relief to letting go, and then you've got the space to grow. And you'd say that relief comes and anger goes, and that's actually a better place to be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the anger can be challenging. Like, I definitely found for ages, I was like, well, I'm not angry. I'm ready to move on with my life and blah, blah, blah. And I went to an amazing counselor, and it's so lovely. People have been asking me for her contact details. She's so good. And she kind of talked to me about how anger can be quite a scary emotion, and how you really need to kind of sit with it. And she described it as like music, that it will crescendo, and that can feel like it's going to overwhelm you, and that can feel very scary. But if you kind of sit with it and try not to avoid it or push it down or deny it, it will go down again. It will, you know, it will die down, and it will pass. So that, I found that really helpful in dealing with any of the difficult emotions, to be honest.
Yeah, we're getting better at that, aren't we? I even notice the way I talk to my kids now, I don't really tell them to stop crying or why are you behaving that way when they're having a tantrum, you know, to just let them feel it and then say, you know, sometimes there's better ways to handle situations.
That's so true. Yeah. I noticed with my daughter at the start of lockdown that she was angry in a way that I wouldn't be her norm. And because I had been through this, I'm much more able now to kind of, instead of me getting scared when she has one of the difficult emotions and kind of going into like a helicopter parent mode where I feel the need to kind of, you know, stop this now and make her better, I'm much more able to be like, oh yeah, no, that's understandable and that's normal and that will pass. And rather than being like, no, don't be angry, don't feel like that, it's okay, everything's okay, you know?
Yeah, just to kind of honor it and allow it out. And I wanted to ask you a bit about lockdown, because you talk a lot in the book about making your home your sanctuary and being okay with being in on a Saturday night and making a little fort for you and your daughter. And did that help you? Because I think a lot of us had our eyes open to the joy and beauty of just being at home over the last little while.
I think in that sense, lockdown can be very challenging for single parents, in that what I found was it made me realize how much people who didn't live under our the same roof as us, but they were really our day-to-day people, my parents, and my daughter sees her dad almost every day. For the first 2 weeks, we weren't able to see any of them because her dad got it and my dad has asthma. So we had to go into 2 weeks isolation. And it was really stressful, you know, because she noticed, I remember the time thinking a lot of my friends' kids were kind of just out in the back garden enjoying it, whereas my daughter got really anxious really quickly. And I think it was because, like that, you know, her kind of base family unit, they don't all necessarily live under the same roof, you know. And that's comforting in a way to know that, like, when you go through a separation, it's really devastating to think your child's father isn't going to live in the same house as them. And in a weird way, it was kind of almost comforting to be like, okay, these people are still have such an impact on her life. But I think for single parents, you know, when your base unit aren't all in the same house and then you go into lockdown and you can't leave your houses, it's really challenging. And we moved over to my parents after 2 weeks and that was amazing. They're very near our house and that's been great. But again, you're kind of thinking, okay, what about in September when we all go back and, you know, she's going to be in school, but my parents are elderly. And it is difficult being in a kind of, you know, fractured, I suppose, is the word, or, you know, where you're
spaced out.
Yeah, where like that, like your, you know, your base unit of family don't all live. So that did present challenges, definitely.
Yeah, their little worlds changed, as did the whole world.
Absolutely. I mean, it presented challenges for everyone, obviously. I mean, we were very lucky. We were able to move over to my parents' house and, you know, huge support there, because obviously I work full time. So that was amazing to have. That has been amazing to have that support.
Well, you do speak a lot about the support, about your friends, about your mum network, about your family. I'm very impressed, as you mentioned, your dad there. He jumped into bed to watch Moana with you and your daughter, which I think is a step further than many granddads would make. But how gorgeous.
Yeah, very lucky.
And it did make me laugh out loud at parts. The whole way we handle bad news, and you talk about, I mean, obviously you start with the breakdown of the marriage and making that decision, but also a very difficult mountain to climb seemed to be telling people and people's reaction and, you know, the head tilters you describe and that kind of pitying look that people give you. And we really struggle with knowing what the right thing to say is, to do is. And you kind of document what worked and what didn't, which I think is so helpful to people.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't expect that. I didn't even think about that as being something that would be challenging, you know, because I suppose you're focused on your own situation and reaction. But telling people was really challenging, and it really took it out of me for various reasons. Some people, and obviously, look, nobody is, you know, and I'm sure I've probably done this myself. I mean, I definitely have. But you know, they react in quite a kind of emotive way. And it's, you know, oh, my God, I can't believe that happened. And, you know, and when you're in the middle of going through something like this, your sense of well-being is so fragile. And, you know, if you're having a good day, you have to really mind that. And so if somebody kind of comes at you with quite an emotional reaction, I remember just feeling like, no, I'm having a good day here. I can't go there with that, you know, and that would be kind of quite draining. I definitely found that people who had been through something themselves, it didn't need to be specifically the same as mine, but they just had a different kind of attitude of like, okay, that's really difficult, but things are going to be okay. You'll get through this. And much more kind of practical. And that's much more comforting, because, you know, in some people's kind of horrified reaction, totally unintentionally, it can kind of make you feel like, oh God, my life is such a mess. And we are just over here, like, you know, we'll never really recover from this. So, and then I suppose other people, like my parents very kindly told, you know, my aunts and my cousins, because I knew they would be gutted in a way that was complete kindness. And I just kind of didn't want to see that, you know, and they were all amazing. They sent text messages and like really practical stuff, like, if, you know, I'm going to Lidl, do you need food, or come to dinner every Tuesday night if you want. And that was really lovely. But and then a few people, and again, I've no doubt done this myself, but, you know, kind of didn't text for months and then would say, I'm so sorry, I just didn't know what to say. And when you're in the middle of something, that could just feel like I just couldn't find the words to address how awful your situation was. Yeah. And again, I mean, I totally understand that, we've all done that. It can be so hard. But I think just saying to people, God, that's really tough, I'm so sorry, is there anything I can do? Or I hope you're okay. You know, is probably better if you can, you know.
Yeah, I've had two friends over the years, one who had breast cancer, the other who lost her father suddenly. And both of them say, send the text message, go to the removal. I know things have changed with that at the moment, but do it. Make the move, because it does really help. The really practical ones that just cut through all the BS and just say,
absolutely,
I'm here for you. If you need anything, give me a shout. You don't have to say anything poetic or eloquent and try to keep your head upright.
That's it. And I think
if you can.
Exactly. Because I think the thing about grief is that it can be quite othering. Like, you can feel like you're kind of over here in your dark little world and everyone else is off over somewhere else having a much, you know, it's just, it makes you feel quite isolated. And exactly like you said there, it doesn't need to be eloquence, because to be honest, if you're in the middle of heavy grief, you're not even really taking in what people are saying. But it's just to have made contact, reached out and made a person feel like they're not isolated and they're not over there, too awful to even kind of manage a conversation, you know.
And you talk a good bit about self-care and self-preservation and suiting yourself, pulling back from certain social situations because you don't want to be the focus of the attention and talk through it all over again. You call it the ability to bow out when you would have pushed on. And I think there's lots of life crises or life changes that remind us to do that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely got its plus sides in that it's kind of freeing like that. And I write about in How to Fall Apart about discovering boundaries for the first time in my adult life. I mean, I really didn't understand what a boundary was. And I'm actually, just because I'm doing the audiobook at the moment, I'm rereading over things and being like, oh yeah, remember that. And it, one of the women I talked to describes it as like minding your energy levels and minding the what energies you let into your world, you know, and kind of, so it's kind of a form of protection. And the thing is, you know, we're all kind of taught, or we all end up kind of doing like, yeah, sure, I can do that, no problem, you know, I'll take that on board and whatever. But when you're in a crisis, you literally just do not have the energy to do that. And so for the first time in my life, I found myself going, saying, no, I can't do that, I can't, you know, and you, because you just literally cannot. And so it kind of gives you that ability, and that can kind of stay with you, because you realize then how beneficial that is when you're protecting, whether it's, you know, maybe people who might be draining or taking on too much or feeling like you should be doing something, but actually it's not really making you very happy. I mean, I think that's the thing about, you know, when you go through something like this and you have to deal with such change in your life, then it makes you brave to look at other aspects of your life and maybe change them where you might not have done that otherwise. Because, you know, if you've, the thing about a relationship ending is that that changes, if you've been living with the person and if you're raising a child with them, it changes every aspect of your life. So then looking at smaller things and adjusting them and what's working and isn't working, you know, becomes less daunting than it might have.
And when you have to dig deep, you have to really get to know yourself, which I just think ultimately is so good for you. And because
Absolutely.
I present this health and wellness show, I often get asked, what is your number one health and wellness tip in various things I do? And I always say it's the fact that I know myself so well.
Yeah.
So I'm able to tune in and listen to myself and act accordingly. And I think the book will help people realize that we're all stronger than we think. And eventually everything can be reconfigured and we can adapt and thrive. Although, does that put you under pressure? Now you say you've picked up the pieces to seem like you have everything together now. I mean, who does?
Absolutely. No. And I think like that's something we really noticed when we started recording the podcast, How to Fall Apart. At the start, the idea was very much, how did you cope in a challenging situation? And really quickly in, we realized that coping can be a bit of a trap, because when everything's really difficult, one of the things you can do when everything else feels out of control is be like, oh, well, I'm coping though. You know, my life is falling apart and everything's really difficult, but look how amazingly I'm coping. And then and you kind of cope yourself into a corner and become really difficult to be like, I'm actually not coping anymore. I'm completely struggling here. So I think it's really important to come at it from a point of view of, you know, you're doing your best. And I suppose, like you said there, you're doing as much to kind of equip yourself with whatever self-knowledge or habits or, you know, things that you know help you to stay, I suppose, mentally buoyant and, you know, feeling as good as you can. But like, that nobody should feel like they have to be some kind of superhero about this kind of stuff.
No, certainly not. Well, look, it's called How to Fall Apart. It's in bookshops now. The podcast has the same name. Leah Dawn Hines, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Claire. Really appreciate it.
So that's it from Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, John Fardy, to Simon Keane and to Jojo Cordoza, who was on sound. I'll see you next week.